Cultivating Place is made possible in part through the generosity of the Cato Shaw Foundation. This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. To round out Women's History Month in style, this week we're back in conversation with Leslie Bennett, Oakland, California-based landscape designer, creating gardens that help to nourish us and tell the story of who we are, individually and collectively. Leslie lives out her horticultural and cultural ethos in her landscape work as well as in her writing and advocacy. Her newest book, Garden Wonderland, written in collaboration with Julie Chai and photographed by Rachel Weil, is publishing on April 2nd from 10 Speed Press. The book brings together all of Leslie's wisdom, spirit, experience, and paradigm-shifting passions. Bringing together the power of women and gardens in our world, Leslie, welcome back to Cultivating Place. Happy spring. I am so excited to be speaking with you again.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. It is genuinely a pleasure to be back speaking with you again.
For listeners who might not remember our previous conversations and or who might not be familiar with your very distinct work, will you remind us of your mission and the work you do in a distilled kind of elevator pitch version? Who are you and what do you do and why does that matter to you?
Yeah, well, what I do is I'm the founder and owner of Pine House Edible Gardens. And a lot of my work centers around this company that I've built over the last 15 years. We design and build productive, that is edible, beautiful landscapes all around the Bay Area, and we take care of them. We maintain them. You know, the design build is its own thing where I'm working with my amazing team of talented designers to create these gardens. And then the maintenance is the other part of our work. And that's a lot of what really informs my work. Like really what I think most interested in is creating these places, creating these gardens, and then getting to know them over time. And because we're in the gardens for so many years after we make them, helping our clients to learn how to grow food, to learn how to cut and arrange flowers, to learn how to really just interpret the natural world that they've, you know, been able to create in their backyard, I've learned so much. You know, it's been a real learning process over the last 15 years. It's been a constant evolution. And I think the heart of my work, I've come to realize, is relationship-based. And I say this to everybody that, you know, if we interview to join the company, is like, this is a relationship-based place of work. And our purpose, my purpose is to, the reason why I got into designing gardens and the reason why I'm still passionate about it is that I want my clients to gain a relationship with the land that they live with. And I think many people don't have that in our modern world. We are in those gardens too. So we get to build relationships with those gardens and with the clients. And then, you know, we, that is myself and my whole team here at Pine House, we get to grow our relationship with ourselves as well and sort of see how we fit into this ecosystem. So I don't know if that's quite an elevator pitch, but
yeah,
but that's great. Yeah, hopefully that helps to communicate, yeah, what's really central to our work. On the surface, I think we look like a garden design build plus maintenance company. Mm-hmm. And then at the center of it, we're all about these relationships and growing them.
That's beautiful. And we are going to unpack so much of that because there is backstory and undercurrent and microbial life all underneath everything you just shared with us. So I do want to go back and have you share with listeners once again your own backstory and the arc of the people and places and plants that grew you into a person who decided that this was her career and life's work. Can you take us down? Where were you born and raised? And we'll walk down that pathway from there to here, Leslie.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about it. You know, it's I guess I'm a person who's okay talking about myself, and also I love my story because it was so unexpected to me. And I kind of love sharing that part of it, because I hope it can inspire other people to realize that unexpected directions could happen for them too. So yeah, I think that, I was born here in the Bay Area in Palo Alto, and grew up with my mom and dad and younger brother, and in many ways had a very, very typical suburban California childhood. It was idyllic in a lot of ways and complicated in others, like so many. But I went to high school, was always really interested in the environment. I remember, I started the environmental club, the Earth Day Club in high school, and I was always really interested in our connection to the earth, and sort of worked with that over time. I was not a gardener. My mom always went outside and in our backyard and gardened and tried to get me involved, and I really wasn't interested as a kid. But as I look back, I'm always just really thankful to her because she took me hiking all the time. She taught me native California plants. She was my Girl Scout leader and led on plant ID, native plant ID for me. And looking back, that was very formative input for me. But mostly I just proceeded as a, I'm a daughter of immigrants. My mom's from England, my dad's from Jamaica. And they were like, well, you're going to be a professional. That's what's going to happen. You're going to be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever other acceptable careers out there. They're also both academics. And I just was sort of pushed toward a highly intellectual education and sort of traditional success-oriented path, which took me to Harvard for college and then to Columbia for law school. And I think all the way along, I was sort of within that box, and I was twisting and turning and sort of connecting with my interests, which all, I studied environmental justice, environmental science with a focus on environmental justice at Harvard. And I decided to focus on land use law at Columbia, and cultural preservation. So I was sort of within the confines of this little box that had been made for me, trying to connect with myself and what I was really interested in. And then I was working in London for a summer of law school, I think. I worked at the Foreign Agricultural Service of the USDA, and ended up writing all these papers about landscape preservation in England and in Europe, and how the agricultural landscapes really affect sort of the collective psyche of a people. Anyways, it involved me interviewing a bunch of farmers in England. And one turning point for me was very much that a farmer I was talking to, I was calling from the US Embassy office in London to some little farm in Dorset. And this woman on the farm who was lovely and had become a friend, she was like, she's like, have you ever been to a farm? Do you know anything?
I love this story.
Yeah, it was funny. It was really, I laughed out loud at the time. I was like, no. And at that moment, I realized I was a total policy wonk, like loser for her. She was one of those annoying people. I was one of those annoying people who wrote about stuff that I didn't actually know, that I'd only read about it in books. And that kind of turned a key for me of that I had been dancing around all this stuff, but not ever stuck my hands in the dirt. From that, I think the next weekend I Googled woofing on the internet. I found some woofing as willing workers on organic farms. I haven't looked at it for a long time, but it's a volunteer program around the world where you can go find organic farms and homestays and go help. So I found several, and I went and spent some weekends weeding out asparagus patches and cutting rhubarb and doing little farmy things. And I loved it. I ended up deciding to do a 2-week permaculture class at a mushroom farm, an apple orchard in Herefordshire.
I remember the apple orchard.
Yeah, there were fun twists and turns.
And there are so many interesting things to this story, which is why I let you just do the whole thing all at one go, because I do hope people hear it and are inspired and delighted and amazed and maybe a little bit sparked in their own lives of like, what am I showing an interest in that I haven't actually embodied yet? And and this beautiful trajectory of learning about policy and law and the very concept of a cultural landscape that is in fact held in common, in a place for our collective identity, no matter who we are. And I remember an earlier conversation where you were talking about the nature of like hedgerows in the United Kingdom, or you know, when you came back to the US, cultural landscapes like the coast or the, you know, Statue of Liberty or, you know, our national parks. And what does it mean? And who gets to write the narrative for these cultural landscapes? And, you know, when I first talked to you, that real like light bulb in my head, understanding that our gardens are all cultural landscapes at some level.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's, I definitely look at that from a sort of, from my legal background informs that is, you know, here in the US, we do have an amazing national park system, but we don't have the, we don't have the collective land access. We don't have the funding for public parks. We don't have the things that other parts of the world do. And really our backyards are our cultural landscapes.
Like, yeah.
They matter. Because we don't have so much of the public stuff. I mean, at least as much as Europe, which is where I spent a lot of time in my 20s. So yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the end of that woofing story was me working in South Africa for a while and then landing on a series of organic farms here in Northern California, where I spent 3 years learning, and Jamaica, I forgot, Jamaica, South Africa, and Northern California, where I learned how to grow food on organic farms and really just dedicated myself to that really hands-on skill. And I was out there with a machete in Jamaica, just weeding and planting arugula. And I was up there surrounded by off the grid folks in Nevada City and deepest Mendocino County, living in a trailer in the woods. I mean, there was chapters, but as I went through all of that, I realized, wow, like I've learned how to grow food. Like I transitioned from being a really typical suburban child of the suburbs, a total in my head and over-educated intellectual desk jockey. You know, I was a corporate lawyer for 18 months. I don't think I left my desk for that 18 months. I just worked and ordered food and, you know, took the bus and the train. So super urban life. And then ended up like farming in the deep woods and realized that I had gotten my hands in the dirt and that I really, there were a lot of just skill. I was excited about learning, about knowing how to grow food, but I really felt like the most impactful and exciting place to kind of apply that knowledge was in people's backyards because of what you just said, because I truly think that there's something iconic and archetypal about the American front and backyard. You know, we all kind of, it may not be true for us, but like, we know like, oh, there's that like green grass lawn and the picket fence. And then the backyard has, you know, another lawn,
a barbecue
and a patio.
Right.
And so we all have this concept, which may not be the best fit for us, may not actually be helping us very much. And so I felt really excited and I'm still really excited about changing what our backyards, I mean, front yards too, but the backyards I think are especially powerful, making them food growing spaces, making them nature growing spaces, making them are connection growing spaces. You know, Americans are lonely and isolated and the modern world is, you know, we're so connected and we're so disconnected. So making our backyards the space where everything that isn't happening can happen and really designing for that.
Yeah.
Which is what the book's about.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Leslie Bennett is an Oakland, California-based landscape designer and writer who creates gardens that help to nourish people and tell the story of who they are. She is founder and principal at Pine House Edible Gardens, founder of Black Sanctuary Gardens, and author most recently of Garden Wonderland, publishing April 2nd from 10 Speed Press. We'll be right back after a quick break to our conversation with Leslie. Stay with us. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by the Cato Shaw Foundation, funding initiatives that empower women and help preserve the planet through the intersection of environmental advocacy, social justice, and creativity. Hey, it's Jennifer. We are across the spring equinox line now. Lean into the light, friends. And as my friend Dino reminded me recently, don't just lean into the light, let it grow you. In the upcoming segment of my conversation, Leslie and I speak more and personally about the reality that our garden spaces and the cultural landscape out of which they are grown is neither neutral nor apolitical, and how that is important progress when we see and are intentional about how we want to grow our gardens from that truth. In a way related to this, recently, Cultivating Place and Pine House Edible Gardens, Leslie and I signed on to a U.S. Gardeners for a Ceasefire in Gaza petition, a call to the Middle East and to the global leadership community to find a way to address complex issues without war, violence, or genocidal offensives. If you would like to read the full call and consider signing the letter yourself in support of people, places, and plants, all having an inherent worth and value and right to thrive, please see the links in this week's show notes under the podcast tab at cultivatingplace.com. May humanity, compassion, diplomacy, and generation, rather than degradation, be among our first ethics as gardeners and as humans. We're back now to our conversation with Leslie Bennett of Pine House Edible Gardens in Oakland, California. With an academic background in environmental justice, land use law, cultural property, and preservation, Leslie's design work, writing, and advocacy are often at the confluence of culture, environment, and horticulture. As we come back, Leslie and I speak about the many ways that culturally grounded home gardens can shift the broader cultural paradigms beautifully and for the better. This includes work in her Black Sanctuary Gardens project.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny, I always forget to talk about Black Sanctuary Gardens, although it is so central to my work, and it's absolutely integrated into Pine. I think it's because it's so integrated into Pine House's work and into our business structure. But, you know, I think one of the really, you know, it's been really hard and it's been really interesting and it's been really great to be able to see it so clearly. But when you're working with landscapes and, you know, literally, you know, I'm a licensed contractor. And so, you know, you're meeting with clients, you're designing, then you're installing, you're then maintaining, you know, I really have gotten to see the literal landscape of America. And, you know, this landscape is not neutral. This landscape is steeped in history. It's steeped in racism. It's steeped in all of the isms that capitalism, it's steeped in everything that we live with. And so, you know, I think it's steeped in all of those things.
Okay, wait, I'm going to jump us back in here by actually having you go back, because we're talking about Black Sanctuary Gardens and we know what we're talking about, but let's bring our listeners back up to speed. What is Black Sanctuary Gardens and how is it embedded in your work structure? And why did you found it, Leslie?
Okay. So, Black Sanctuary Gardens is it is a series of gardens created with and for Black women here in the Oakland area. And it's really a reflection of my wish to that same like archetypal American landscape that we all have in our brains. I was like, where am I? Where are we? Where are the Black people? And I came to a realization that I wanted to see what I wanted to see in my brain and in the media that surrounds me and in the world is images of Black women at rest in plant-centered spaces, gardens. And so I set myself to creating them. And that is the series of Black Sanctuary Gardens. So they're home gardens for Black women in the Oakland area that are. Basically, we just meet the premise is also to meet Black women where they are. So some of them are self-funded by the women who want to be in the project, and some of them are funded, heavily funded or fully funded. But it's basically inviting Black women in my community to step into garden space and to have a garden of their own that reflects them, that nurtures them, that celebrates them, and then to a second part of the project, in addition to making the garden with these women, is to take portraits of them, and that's sort of the art project of it, and have those be in the world because I felt like that's what the world needed. So again, I'm not sure that's the most pithy description. Did that make sense?
No, it absolutely made sense. And it's such a beautiful kind of riff off of write the book you always wanted to read. And you are changing what the word gardener and garden mean and look like in our most superficial American version. Because, of course, all people have gardened across all time. It has never been the space of just one person. But there was, certainly over this last 150 years, let's say, with increasing marketing and media, this weird perception that just one slice of human gardened and they looked a certain way. And to push back hard against that is a beautiful exercise in liberation for us all, by the way.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely and oddly, now it feels normal to me and it's so central to my work and it's just what we do. But it was the hardest thing to do. It took me a good 10 years to figure out like how do I figure out how to deal with this concept of gardening, which is this white, wealthy leisure activity with what I know to be the truth, which is that we are all born in relationship with nature and plants and are intended to and have the right to have these relationships and have been historically, but we're so separated from it because of forces outside ourselves. So yeah, it was really hard to figure it out. And I agree. I think it's a really powerful shift, and it's something I'm so happy about and so proud of. And that's sort of what I was talking about when I was saying, working as a design build maintenance company in the Bay Area, the landscapes we're working on are not neutral. They are shaped by all these forces. And the majority of my clients are wealthy and white. And that's not just me. That's probably every landscape designer in America. And that is whenever that happens, I know there's a problem. Something is not right. And so I sort of set myself to looking at that, shifting that. And one of the exciting things about the Black Sanctuary Gardens with my business is that I built in an equity pricing framework so that all of my standard clients, regardless of their race, they have the option to make an equity contribution, which is usually like a 1 to 4% contribution on their design fees or their install fees. And then those funds go into a pot that supports Black Sanctuary Gardens. And the Black Sanctuary Garden funds support the creation of these gardens for Black women, also for Indigenous and disabled folks. And just try to really broaden the range of who actually gets to have a garden, who actually gets to feel the effects of that in their lives, and then also taking photos at documenting that so that we all get to see something different.
Yeah. And what I want to really underline right there for listeners to grapple with and enjoy and sort of savor is the creative thinking and reimagining that went into how you made this structure happen. I mean, when you and I first talked about it, again, there was this light bulb moment of there isn't just one way to do something, and we can reimagine and restructure the way we conceive of finances, the way we conceive of a business structure to make what we want to see happen, happen. And you did that. And it's a beautiful formula of asking those who can to help those who can't, and to create equity where we are so frequently finding ourselves distressed at inequity. This is one of those moments where it is equity starting right on the ground where you are in the ways that you can. And it's just, it's beautiful.
Well, thank you. And you've been such a supporter, and I appreciate that so much. And I'm like, we could have a whole episode about Black Secretary Gardens, and I believe we will. So all to come. But I was one other thing, and this relates to the book as well, is that, you know, one of the exciting things about the Black Secretary Gardens project was that I was so curious. I didn't know what these gardens would look like, you know,
right?
You know,
right.
Like we have this image in our head of like what a backyard garden is, and then I had this idea. I was like, I want to see some more Black gardens. I want to know what, and I want these gardens. I want to see gardens that reflect Black women. And you know, I felt very aware. I know Black people are not a monolith. there is no such thing as a Black garden,
right?
And so I was so curious what they would turn out to. And that's been really one of the most joyous things of the process, is truly this this vivid, alive illustration of how diverse we are as Black women and Black people, and what a range we hold. And of course, you know, I think we're on our ninth Black Sanctuary Garden. We do at least one each year with the collected funds. And I think three or four of them are included in the book. And
yep,
they're wildly different and wildly creative and wildly amazing. And that's really so exciting and so rewarding. And as much of a like learning and like thrill for me to encounter as I think it will be for anybody else.
Yeah. Okay. So this moves us perfectly to the book, Garden Wonderland, which is this compilation of documenting your philosophy, your practice, your process, your team, and then these a handful of the many gardens you have done across your career that kind of exemplify the range, the scope, and the beauty of what a cultural, edible, beautiful, relationship-based garden looks like through your eyes. So take us to the point at which you said, okay, I think I'm ready for a book to bring some of these things together. Like, what was the, you know, germination point for the book? And then tell us about the colleagues who partnered with you on it.
Great. I think the book had been brewing with me in a way for a while, in the sense that it was 2019, 2020. I had sort of created a body of gardens with my team, and I basically had a bunch of really beautiful gardens that were mature. I had been in relationship with the clients for a long time. So, you know, I knew them. I'd been working with them for 5 to 10 years, seeing how the gardens shaped their lives and being like genuinely quite thrilled by it. You know, I'd go and stop by a garden, I'd talk, and they'd be like, well, this week, like this happened in the garden and this is how it changed my life. I'm like, wow, that's so cool. Like, I thought this garden might work for you, but it really is. And there was so much of that feedback coming back to me. And I think one of the things about gardens too is that, you know, we all know they don't last forever they're not static. You know, they change. They can last forever, but they shift over time. And there was just this feeling like, oh, like things are coming together. Like there's like a lot of beauty to show here, a lot of inspiration and a lot of just meaningfulness that I want to be able to capture and share with the world. And then at around that same time, you know, I'd been good friends with Julie Chai, back since 2013, or you know, a long a decade before, when she had been an editor at Sunset Magazine and had been one of my first supporters, wrote the very first media article about me. And she and I started talking, really, you know, a lot of this generated around in 2020, around the time of COVID, around George Floyd, around the fire, like all that intensity that we went through it and are still going through. But we ended up connecting on the phone actually around Black Sanctuary Gardens. And she had been talking and supporting me with it sort of over the years. And then in the summer of 2020, we decided to launch a fundraiser and take things up a notch. And we started talking on the phone like every day. We talked about George Floyd. We talked about race. We talked about our gardens. We talked about our work. We just talked about everything. And we really, I think, found a real connection in each other that was very much based on us both being mixed race women. Myself as a mixed race Black woman, and Julie as a mixed race Asian woman, who both were in deep relationship with gardens. And I mean, we've had the funniest, most wonderful ride. I'm like, you know, I like I'll so many conversations. And I was telling her about my gardens. You know, it was in the pandemic. I was driving, I was putting in food gardens. I was coming back to my neighborhood in East Oakland, which was heavily hit by COVID. I was traversing the landscape of America in like a really graphic way through the pandemic. And I was sort of processing a lot of it with Julie, both the really hard and ugly things and the really beautiful things. And along the way, I told her about my book, that I had this idea around cultural landscapes and how gardens can really support us. And she said she was going to help me to flesh it out. And so she did. Bless her. She really, really helped me to flesh it out. She's such a talented and experienced writer and bookmaker. And so she helped me to shape a proposal, and we pitched it to 10 Speed Press, who approved it. We decided to get Rachel Weil to work with us as a photographer, and really specifically chose to work with her because we really wanted photos that felt alive and intimate and warm and authentic. It was a very intense time that when this book was generated.
Yes.
I guess what we both felt is that we were living in this very intersectional, complex place that was racially and in many other ways in America at that time, that was very painful and very hard. And we saw the potential of gardens to heal and help and bring joy and support everybody. And we wanted to make a book that that would speak to everybody, that would be sort of different from what was out there, which is, you know, one big part of that is the racial component, like a book that didn't only feature white people frolicking in their gardens, a book that felt authentic and real, not sort of like the staged Instagram magazine perfect gardens. And we really wanted a place to like put our very intersectional perspective and lived experience, and also embrace the fact that everybody has that, regardless of race. And I think this comes across in the book a lot, is that, you know, we have this wide range of people in the book living in different size spaces, different areas, different backgrounds. And everybody holds these complexities, and everybody has these different layers. And I think because of our sort of layered intersectional backgrounds, we were able to really draw those out and highlight them. And that was our goal, was to really show the humanity of people and how the humanity of these people can relate to plants and nature in the garden.
This is Cultivating Place. I'm Jennifer Jewell. Leslie Bennett is an Oakland, California-based landscape designer and writer who creates gardens that help nourish people and tell the story of who they are. She is founder and principal at Pine House Edible Gardens, founder of Black Sanctuary Gardens, and author, most recently, of Garden Wonderland. We'll be right back after a quick break to our conversation with Leslie. Stay with us. Hey, it's Jennifer again. As you listen to this week's episode, I'm traveling in the Midwest, between Grand Rapids, Michigan, where I spoke at the Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park in Grand Rapids, and South Bend, Indiana. In South Bend, we will be recording and filming the first of the Cultivating Place Live Dialogues to Grow By episodes, made possible by the Caddo Shaw Matching Grant awarded to Cultivating Place this year. I can't wait to let you know how this first one goes and maybe even share some early sound or film clips. We are very close to meeting our $75,000 match. We have just $15,000 to go. We have raised an amazing $60,000 towards the match to date. Many of you have asked for more information about the grant and what it is supporting in the work of Cultivating Place. There are three pathways built into the grant, all in process right now. One, to make the program financially sustainable into the future. Two, to work on a succession plan for Cultivating Place beyond me as the sole voice or face. And finally, third, to create a series of special Cultivating Place Live Dialogues to Grow By episodes around the country in celebration and support of the places we are recording and the intentional and beautiful cultivation of these places by the humans living there. We're designing and beginning to plant the seeds down each of these pathways, so stay tuned for more about each of them, including announcements for the two new guest host voices being rolled into the program later this year, and announcements about some of the other Cultivating Place Live programs in planning. As I mentioned earlier, a few episodes back, I definitely am excited, but also anxious, the way we are when we're waiting to see if our seeds will really germinate again this year. If you would like to participate in helping us meet this match, you can chip in any amount through the support button at the top of every page at cultivatingplace.com. If you'd like to make a larger donation and receive a tax-deductible receipt, checks can be made out to North State Public Radio with a notation that the funds are in support of the Cultivating Place Matching Grant, and they can be mailed to North State Public Radio, attention Sarah Bohannon, 35 Main Street, Suite 101, Chico, California, 95928. Thank you most recently to Marcy, Alan, Catherine, Janet, Crystal, Pliny and Ruth, Abigail and Dave, Sabrina, Flora, Diana, David, and Carol, Phil, and Joanne, and Anonymous. And thank you. Every contribution, every listener means the world to this communal virtual place we cultivate here on this program together. We're back now to our conversation with Leslie Bennett of Pine House Edible Gardens and Black Sanctuary Gardens. Her most recent book, Garden Wonderland, emphasizes not only the importance of culture in our horticulture, but the importance of wonder in our world. So I should have read the whole title. Garden Wonderland, and I'm saying Wonderland in that way because the way it is depicted on the book is that Wonderland is one word, but the wonder part of it is in italics, so that it has this special emphasis. And the subtitle is How to Create Life-Changing Landscapes for Beauty, Harvest, Meaning, and Joy. When you came up with that title or agreed to that title, since I know how titles work, what were you hoping to evoke in the Garden Wonderland part of it, Leslie?
I think in the Garden Wonderland part of it, very much the emphasis on wonder. And, in some ways it kind of goes back to my, my memories of, I don't know, my life before when I worked at my desk and took the train home and ate my lunch at my desk and just kind of was living a very disconnected life. And then just like that feeling of stepping into a more organic land-based life where, I felt the breeze on my skin and felt my hands in the soil and like really felt the wonder of the world. That really sort of transformational experience that I had way back when. And then also just every day. Like I think that's what I always aim for in every garden that my team and I design is let's create moments of wonder. Let's create this moment that takes you away from the ordinary, from the mundane, from the bus route, from the grocery list, from the tedious things that we have to do to, be adults in the world. And like, let's just create this place that's truly wonderful and takes your breath away and lifts you up. And nature does some of that work. And then we also get to co-create with nature and like highlight things and design for certain experiences. And I just love that. Like I love an entry that just, there's a plant growing over, a canopy and you walk under and it opens up into a space that feels a certain way. And that's what gets me excited about garden making. And so I wanted to highlight that.
And all of that becomes clear on the pages in word, but also in Rachel's beautiful, evocative photography.
Yeah, they're so beautiful. I loved how her photos turned
It's
out.
so beautiful. So the book is laid out in two larger basic parts. The first one is the how-to, and the second is the inspiration. And you talk about what a garden wonderland is, how to create one, some instructions on how to get started for yourself, on how to use plants for form, function, and delight is one of the titles of a chapter in section one. And then in section two, you document and profile some of these. And there are edible wonderlands, floral wonderlands, healing wonderlands, gathering wonderlands, and cultural wonderlands. Now, for me, I'm not sure why, but the gathering and the cultural wonderlands really stuck out to me as a beautiful addition to things we do expect. Like we expect a conversation on edible gardens, on floral gardens, and on healing. But these other two, to me, I thought, oh, those were good additions.
I think that those are sort of like the life-changing elements. I mean, they're all the life-changing elements, but when
They
I think
are.
about the things that we want to be able to do in our gardens, or that we need, maybe better put is like the things we need support in doing, because a lot of I'm going to take it back just a minute and then come to that, but I think a big premise of this book is that plants are our allies and can help us. And I think we all have that feeling if you go for a hike, or if you go to the beach, and have that contact with nature, plants, you get that clarity, you get that lift. But we can have that in our backyards, and the plants can help us in a lot of ways, but in several specific ways to literally make our lives better. And I think the food part is pretty clear. That's been pretty well fleshed out by the slow food movement, et cetera, over the last 10 years. Like, grow the food, it's organic, it's healthy, you're connected. The flowers, that was a lesson for me over the last 10 years because I started out in organic farming, and kind of came to flowers later. And then I was like, oh my God, flowers make me so happy. These are
So
amazing.
happy.
So happy. I don't have to be so utilitarian and I don't know. Flowers are always pitched as being frivolous, when in fact they are really important, and they literally sustain the world with pollination, et cetera, and they literally bring us the joy that is life sustaining. So there's that, and then there's the medicine part, which I think is super interesting, and there's so much work there about how the plants we grow in our yard can actually heal us in so many different ways. And then I think, as you're saying, like the part, I think people think, oh, a patio to get together. And that's fine. You do need a space, a patio space. But you know how it looks and feels, what it's surrounded by. I just talked about like an entrance that has a canopy overhead. You know, what you surround your patio with really affects how inviting it is, how you actually feel when you're there with your people, your family, your friends, your community, and really creating a space that supports you in gathering. You know, there's such a whether or not you decide to invite friends over for an afternoon barbecue or an evening pizza night, it really depends, I think, on how well your garden is set up to support you, how well it's designed to
Right.
support gathering. And I
Right.
think when we gather more, we are more connected, we are happier, we are all the things that I think we want to be, just as you were saying, like sort of happier, better people in the world. And I think the next if you're feeling better, you're able to be a better member of the community and an agent of positive change in the world. That's sort of like the end of that arc. And so anyway, so the gathering I think is super important. Yeah, and we have some beautiful stories in the book. One of them that I love is she's become a good friend, but she's got a really sweet small backyard in East Oakland that was not inviting for having people over. And we created this really lush, beautiful, edible, with citrus and elderberries and pineapple guavas and then tons of flowers, but also just low maintenance lushness, so that her backyard became this real oasis. And the highlight of her life is entertaining, but she did not have the space. And now she's got this big dining table in the middle. There's several different seating areas, and Malaika is her name. She has people over in her backyard every weekend of the summer, and it truly brings out. She's a natural hostess, and she gathers with her neighbors. Her entire neighborhood comes over. They make limoncello and vin d'orange from all the various citrus in her garden. They have pizza night. The kids interact. You know, all the things happen.
Right.
And that didn't happen before the garden because the space did not exist for it. So in a very concrete way, that garden facilitated gathering that was really good for her soul, her family's soul, and her community's soul.
Right. I think one of the reasons that calls to me is something you said earlier in the conversation about this pandemic, this sort of parallel pandemic to the COVID-19 pandemic and the racism pandemic that we live with is this one of isolation and loneliness. And, in our gardens, we are never alone. We always have the plants and the animals that come to them as well. But when we can include humans, we do build community that is the antidote for that loneliness and disconnection. And I think that I wanted to read about that so much,
Great. Yeah, I think it's medicine that we need, and as much as anything else. And yeah, and I think the cultural part, I also love that so much, because I think another big thing that a lot of us feel is just it's a disconnection. It's a not knowing how we fit in, or just maybe knowing part of the story. And part of that is just modern life. You know, people move away from the town they were born in. You know, just people mobility is a lot more these days. And then to come back to the racial part, you know, I think so much of this culture that we live in, which is, you know, a white supremacy culture in whiteness in general, is about erasing like true histories of white Americans. So many white Americans don't know their history. It's been erased by the story of whiteness, which is untrue. And so they're disconnected from their stories. And then other people are disconnected in other ways, you know, whether it's forcible movement or just movement or whatever it is. You know, there's lots of layers there, which can be put into better words, but I think you get the idea.
I
So
do. Yeah.
we all have this. I think this wish to, I mean, I think regardless of our culture, we all do have a wish to belong. And that's a big part of just being a human. And we're all trying to do that in this American landscape that is really hard. You know, there are a
Yeah.
lot of things that are like setting us up to not feel like to not know what we belong to, or to know if we belong
Yes.
at all, or who we belong to. You know, and the fact is we belong to each other. And so I think gardens can really help by, taking us back to our ancestral traditions, which were for all of us, whoever we are in the world, we all go back to plant-based traditions.
Yes, yes.
And that's just a truth.
Yeah.
And we can either be aware of it or not. And I think creating a garden, and you and I have talked about this. I remember we talked about the idea of a garden as a was it a treasure chest, a
Yeah.
like a covenant
Yeah.
for culture, and the fact that you can, and from my mind, and I do this all the time with my clients, I'm like, what matter, like what, how can we access this? And some people don't know. They're like, I don't know. I don't really know what my culture is. And we seek back. We're like, do you remember anything that your grandma used to do? Do you remember anything about the place that you grew up? Did you, maybe your family's from somewhere that you never even went? Did you have an idea or an imaginary vision of what that might be? Or looking forward, like, do you have a vision of like what you would like your life to be like in the future, and like how you'd like it to look and feel, and how you'd like to engage with people? And that is all culture. And you get to build that in with your family and with your garden. And so I invite clients, and you see in the book, we can plant an apple tree, and we can pick those apples every fall and make apple pie. And that
Yeah.
can be, that can be your thing. It can be like an American thing. It can be whatever, however you choose to hold that. Or you can choose to, grow medicine, or you can choose to grow flowers, and be the person, family, home that always has fresh flowers. And I think that that's important. That's an as important of a cultural element as, what I think a lot of people, as any other cultural thing. So
Yeah.
anyway, I just think gardens have this, you can plant the seeds of some things literally, and then they grow, and you get to see where they take you. And you are literally growing your own culture
Yeah.
with a garden. And it's such a creative, it's one of the hardest things to talk about, and one of the hardest things to design for. And it's truly pretty unexpected, where things will go. But I think it's one of the most interesting to me. And I do love the stories in the book that kind of explore. There's one woman who includes a couple. She's Jewish and includes several things that she can use in ceremonial ritual elements, ritual practices. There's another client who is sort of rewilding himself.
Yeah.
That's also a cultural practice. There's my own home garden, which is full of my Jamaican and English plants, the plants that matter to my family lineage. And another client who's Italian American and taps back into her grandparents' sort of self-sufficiency and food growing and preservation, and is passing that down to her grandchildren. So I think it's all super, it's super just interesting stuff to chew on, and I love the stories we were able to draw out.
Definitely. And that those models of people choosing the culture they want to grow forward, they're so powerful to me because, no matter what culture you come from, there
Yes.
will be parts of it that you might not want to take forward.
Exactly.
And if you come from, a suburban middle class American culture of television and capitalism and the barbecue out back, to be able to regenerate that full of more life and contribution and diversity and is like that is one of the most powerful actions we can take back from the monolith that is our mainstream culture right now and offer to our children as really powerful values going forward. And you're doing it all from this basis of these gardens, Leslie. I mean, it is truly transformational.
Yay! Well, that's my favorite word when it comes to gardens. I truly
Yes.
believe that gardens are transformational spaces,
Yeah.
where we can grow the world that we want for ourselves and our families and our communities. And I say it like that because I say it a lot, because I think
Yes, I
it's
do.
true. But I think it's absolutely the case. And I think, as you're saying that, I'll just add, I think it's what's so, I think, comes naturally in the garden is the sense of compassion and like acceptance of how things are. The culture, we all, I agree, we all come from somewhere, and we get to pick and choose the parts that we choose to kind of grow forward. And we may choose to continue some of the like stuff that's not so great, or, we may choose to like have the barbecue or, create the
I
waste or
love my
like,
barbecue.
yeah,
Okay, let's just face it. I do. So.
And I think that's the authentic part. Like, we're not like perfect people,
No.
and we get to include it all, and we can have the beautiful and the less beautiful, and it's all part of what belongs. And I think really just actively and compassionately choosing those things, and then, literally dedicating your time and your resources and things to growing that in your space, is really healing. It's just a really healing act. So, yeah, and that is my hope for the book, is that everybody sees themselves. We made a lot of effort for people to be able to see themselves in the book, and hopefully to, get the idea that plants are our friends, they can support us, and that you can transform your own outdoor space into a garden that really supports you and makes your life better, in whatever way or shape or form that means to you.
It is a wonderland.
Yay.
Final question. If you had five plants, you would not, you, Leslie Bennett, with your two beautiful young children, would not want to garden or cultivate or hike or live without, what would those five plants be and
I
why?
love your plant questions. And it is funny because I've answered this before, and things change. And
Yes.
that's cool too. But one that is the same for me is the rose. And I think I've had a long and complex relationship with the rose. It's been a source of healing for me in lots of different ways. And I just love roses. There's nothing that beats them. And I didn't start out liking them in my gardening journey. I had a lot of preconceptions. And but yeah, I just love the lush blooms. A big bunch of roses and being able to cut them and put them in a vase is, I would not like to live without that. Culinary bay is my next one. I have found that to be an incredibly healing plant. And yeah, I've just developed, again, sort of, I planted it in my yard for just to have to make soup, frankly. I just thought it was kind
Yep.
of cool. It's an evergreen plant. And then over the years, I've realized that it is a really powerful plant for me, in terms of plant medicine. And it's funny, it's one of those plants I've had a strong connection with but didn't realize. And I laughed recently because I think over the last 15 years, with however many hundreds of gardens my team and I have put in, I think every single client has a culinary bay, because I'm like, you need a culinary bay.
Leslie was here.
I'm like, that's okay, I don't need it. I'm like, no, you do. You do. You need one.
Trust me, you don't even know you need it.
Totally. So everyone gets a culinary bay, and everyone will find their healing path with it. I certainly have. Let's see, I love snapdragons, which feels so cheesy and lame, but they're so pretty, and they last so long, and they work so well in veggie beds. They're edible, they're great in arrangements. I just love them. There's so many pretty
Kids love them.
versions.
Come
Kids love
on.
them. Yeah, they're just great. So I love the snapdragons. I love a plum or a pluot tree. That is my favorite summer fruit. And there's just, I don't know, that really epitomizes to me like the joy of picking fresh fruit off the tree on a warm, sunny day. So there's that. And
One more.
one more is just ferns. I like ferns a lot.
Okay.
Just all of them. They're so pretty.
Well, and in the Bay Area, you can grow so many good ferns.
So
Oh,
many. And the ones I
yeah.
can't put outside, I put inside. They're just great. And I don't even know what their names are. Like, I'm actually really bad at ferns. That's not my area of
Ferns
expertise.
they're
I just
tough.
like them.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So much beautiful foliage. I really love foliage. So
Yeah.
yeah, so
Oh.
those are my plants for you.
That is a very nice combination. Now, I just want to circle back to the rose because I recently saw I saw something, sort of dissing the colonialism of the rose. And it was funny because I got a little defensive for the rose. I'm like, now wait a second. There are native roses on almost every single continent. Like
That's true.
they are so powerfully healing and sturdy and protective and habitat and we should not let the colonial narrative contract
Absolutely.
the importance of the rose to the world.
I totally agree. I know, and that you're totally summing up what I lived through. But yeah, I completely associated them with like older white women who had nothing in common with me.
Right.
My grandma in England kind of vibe. And I was like, that is not a flower for me. It's not cool enough. It's not inclusive enough. It's not anything enough. And I really kind of looked down on them when I started. They were not for me. I could do something better. And over time, again, just planting them for clients who requested them, then, being like, wow, that's really nice. I like that. Kind of getting more comfortable with them. And then I took a plant medicine class, and we were each asked to choose a plant to have a relationship, to grow a relationship with. And I chose the rose because I knew there was something nutty in there for me. And my mom's family said there's a deep white colonial, super racist, super intense lineage that has been a lot for me to grapple with in my life. And so a lot of it was the rose. For whatever reason, holds a lot of that for me. And, I got to work with rose salve. I worked with rose tincture. I worked with rose essential oils. I worked with rose petals. And I just was with them. It was like an 8-week course. And at the end of it, I was like, this rose has a lot of medicine for me. This is healing. And it is, it's heart medicine. It's all the herbalists can tell you all the things, but it is truly medicine. And now they're like my favorite thing. And I'm so glad that the plant, the rose gave me the space to work through. I think we all have, parts of our family or parts of our history that are harder or hurtful or, less well. And I th maybe that's an example, hopefully, of, how we can kind of work with and embrace and pull in and heal the parts of us that are more painful and do that. I truly feel like the rose helped me to process that. And that's what I would wish for everybody, is that they find the plant that helps them to feel better.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Well, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you again. The new book is such a beautiful offering that just carries forward your messages on so many levels. And I just thank you for your time in this conversation today, but in our world generally, Leslie.
Thank you so much. And I always just feel really heard talking with you, and it's so nice to get to connect and be in conversation. And I know that you're very much a part of, we're very aligned in the work that we're doing, and so I'm thankful for you as well.
Leslie Bennett is an Oakland, California-based landscape designer and writer who creates gardens that help to nourish people and tell the story of who they are. With an academic background in environmental justice, land use law, cultural property, and preservation, Leslie is the founder and owner of Pine House Edible Gardens, a landscape design-build firm that creates aesthetic edible gardens and productive outdoor spaces. Leslie works collaboratively with the Pine House design team to create culturally grounded gardens that provide as much visual inspiration as they do organic harvests of food, flowers, and medicinal herbs. As a Black-owned company and woman-led team, Pine House Edibles supports making gardens accessible to all through their unique equity pricing program that supports their Black Sanctuary Gardens project, a series of garden spaces created in collaboration with Black women and Black communities in and around Oakland, California. Creating places of respite and beauty that celebrate Black communities is essential to the Pine House Edibles team growing a more beautiful and equitable world together. Leslie and her team believe that an edible garden can be a transformative space to grow and cultivate the world we want for ourselves and for our communities. Join us again next week when, with spring and seeding season fully underway indoors and out, we speak with gardener and entrepreneur
Ann Fletcher of Orta Kitchen Gardens, creators of ceramic, self-watering Orta seed pots, helping to eliminate plastic right from the start in your plants' growing lives. That's next week, right here. Listen in. Cultivating Place is a co-production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio licensed to Chico State Enterprises. Cultivating Place is made possible in part by listeners just like you through the support button at the top of every page at cultivatingplace.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. Cultivating Place is also made possible through the generosity of the Caddo Shaw Foundation. The Cultivating Place team includes producer and engineer Matt Fidler, tech and web support from Angel Hiracha, weekly show transcripts by Doulis Transcription. We're based on the traditional and present homelands of the Machupta Indian tribe of the Chico Rancheria. Original theme music is by Ma Muse. Until next week, enjoy the cultivation of your place. I'm Jennifer Jewell.